I have some remarks to make which will hopefully enable us to understand how Islam places itself in the context of biblical religion, particularly the Abrahamic environment, which I talked about at the beginning of last night's remarks. Then I want to move on to speak of Islamic orthopraxy, or law, the Sharia, and then to say something about the distinction between the communities in Islam, the Sunnis and the Shi'is that we hear so much about on the media, read about in the media. And then perhaps if you are interested, we could spend some time on the tariqa, or the Sufi way, the mystical way, which is in many people's minds the heartbeat of Islam. After that, rather than go into a cold-blooded rehearsal of the last 500 years of Islamic history, which would put us all to sleep, I would be happy to answer any questions on the emergence into the modern world of Islam, but it might be that we will have things to talk about and to raise up as concerns based just on the last few years of our own history vis-a-vis our Muslim brothers and sisters. So, I was talking about the notion that Islam is both religion and state, and I suppose I can erase this now. I should have begun by saying Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Merciful, the Compassionate. Islam, I like to speak of as an orthoprax system, if we can use this kind of ugly word, as distinguished from an orthodox system. Both of these have to do with making something correct or straightening it or right. Orthodontistry, orthopedics. Docs would have to do with doctrine, or in some cases, praise, as in the doxology. Prax, praxis, practice. These are just alternative words, I suppose, for an emphasis on thinking and an emphasis on doing. Or creeds, you might say, such as creeds, and doing, ritual. I would say that in the Abrahamic traditions, Judaism and Islam are very orthoprax in their concerns, and Christianity tends toward the orthodox. This is not to say that each of these three religions is devoid of concern for both sides, both poles, certainly. But I'm just making an analytical distinction, which is helpful at the level of behavior and the level of theology, of reflection, and even of community structures. Theology in Islam and Judaism is relatively recessive. It's there. But in Christianity, it's front and center, and it always has been, right from the beginning. In fact, much of the New Testament is theology. I would submit that most of Paul's letters are really theological, in the sense that they are attempts to make an intellectual structure of the faith, for purposes of defense or apologetic, and for purposes of communication, preaching, proclamation, and persuasion. This is not so true of either Judaism or Islam. Paul's major distinction in the book of Romans is between law and gospel. Law, he eschews in favor of the freedom of life in Christ and in the Spirit and the new being. Where one launches out into uncharted waters with the law, you might say, if I may use that word in quotes, the law of love, which is a spontaneous principle. And also a great deal of intellect, which is also at work in Paul's approach. There's a great deal of intellect at work in this side as well, but it generally is a more Talmudic intellect, or an exegetical intellect, or one that seeks to apply the word to the world in the area of behavior, in the area of community structures, in the area of institutions. I was teaching quite a few years ago at Yale, and there was a little Eskimo in that igloo, and there was a very gray old rabbi who's one of the world's leading scholars of the Talmudic tradition. He had a chair at Yale at the time, but he was a very dear colleague and helpful to me. And I went and I asked him one day, his name was Judah Golden, and I said, Judah, I've got to teach something about Judaism in this class of mine. And, you know, I've read about it and so on, but I want to teach a little bit about Jewish theology. And he said, Fred, save your time. There isn't any. And then he clarified that remark by saying, oh, okay, there's a little. And then so he had a little book that he had written about it. People who tried to do theology in Judaism did it brilliantly, but nobody listens. They may listen, but they argue or they disagree and so forth. And I would say that argumentation is a way of being religious in the Jewish tradition. They have built-in fraud detectors, it seems, and they go at each other. And Judah did this himself. But this is instructive, and later when I was doing much more work in the Islamic tradition, I noticed many similarities between Judaism and Islam in this respect. In the Middle Ages, in the West, we know that theology was regarded as the queen of the sciences, and philosophy was the handmaiden of theology. Well, neither theology nor philosophy has been, philosophy was the handmaiden of theology, neither of those has ever been the queen or the king or even the duke of the sciences. In Islam, the premier science has always been this one, which is called fiqh, which is best translated as jurisprudence, legal theory and practice, not just theory, but practice especially. And this is all under the notion of the Sharia. The Sharia is perhaps the single most important concept to understand in Islamic religion. It is functionally analogous to the Torah in more than one sense. Torah, of course, we know as the scrolls of the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Hebrew Bible. But Torah is not limited to the Torah book, to the Pentateuch. Torah is larger than this. Torah is eternal. Torah is the legislation of God. It's the will of God. It's the command of God. It's the way the world runs. It's the way the universe is constructed. It's the dynamic and the principle of all that is. Similarly with Sharia. Sharia is, like Torah, often translated as law. But that can be accepted only if we think of it as law with a capital L. The whole principle, the whole spirit of law coming from God. Not legalism, not little laws, not code so much as the whole idea of the ordaining of the way. Sharia means way. It really means road in Old Arabic before it came to be appropriated by the Islamic tradition. It means a special road, the road to the waterhole. And that's a very important road in Arabia because that's the road to life. Back and forth. And if you miss that road, you would die. And so it's a very piquant term for those who are prepared to listen and to understand what it really means. It's the road of life. It's the way of life. So Sharia is very important. And we appropriate, we understand, and we apply the Sharia through fiqh. Fiqh literally means understanding. Fiqh is understanding. Systematic understanding. Sophisticated understanding. So it's, in Islamic terms, jurisprudence, that kind of understanding. And it developed over the first 3 to 4 centuries of Islamic history as a highly differentiated, variegated, sophisticated congerie or blending of different elements as the Islamic movement ventured out into the Middle Eastern world and into the North African, the Asian, the European, African worlds. It came in contact with many different cultures and different local laws, different customs. The Quran and the teachings of Muhammad have always been very adaptable to local conditions. This is one of the secrets of the success of Islam's reception in many parts of the world, is the enormous flexibility. We are, I think, conditioned by our media often to think of Islam as a monotheistic and rigid and highly regimented, narrow-minded, intolerant sort of phenomenon. There are elements of all of those things in Islam, just as there are in other great religions. But once you begin to understand Islam from the inside and you know something of the history, and not just the short view of the last few years of radical revival, which has its own survival value, for peoples, then you begin to see that Islam has a tremendous breadth of heart, an enlargement of breasts, as it says in the Quran, in the sense of being magnanimous, being generous. Even today, in west central Sumatra, an area called Minangkabau, there is a matrilineal, even though it is one of the strictest Sunni Islamic areas in the world, with people knowing Arabic as well as their native language, spending a great deal of time in the mosque, and being among the most fanatical of supporters of the pilgrimage of the Hajj to Mecca. Yet still, the husband must visit his wife. He cannot stay in her home. He has to leave at dawn. Grandma owns all the property. And the husband leaves to go to Jakarta or to Singapore or to Surabaya to run a restaurant or import-export. The husbands have become very good businessmen. They're like Armenians, Jews, or Chinese in other parts of the world. They tend to be able to move about and to handle life very fluidly and very easily, whereas the women stay at home and tend to the property. Now, this is not stereotypical Islam at all, where the women are so powerful. But this is the way it is there. Islam, in the classical international tradition from the Middle East, has realized that it is dealing with an entrenched local tradition, and therefore it accommodates. It is slowly winning, very slowly, in the sense of breaking down the matrilineal, but not head-on, but only by gradual change of people's opinions about the matrilineal as the world opens up. It's not just Islam, but it's the media revolution in the 20th century, and the way other peoples besides Muslims outside of Sumatra live. But I just wanted to give you some sense of the tremendous fluidity and the openness to local custom. So we have Sharia, we have fiqh, we have jurisprudence. What do we have in this whole configuration? We have what Sir Hamilton Gibb, the late Sir Hamilton Gibb, used to call in Islam a profound distrust of human reason. There's a sense in which reason can really lead us into damnation that you find in Islam, unless it's subordinated to revelation. The second century Christian theologian, you may be familiar with the name, North African Roman jurist by the name of Tertullian, once asked a question, and I know you know Tertullian, what has Athens to do with Jerusalem? And his opinion was, not a damn thing. But that question haunts the Abrahamic traditions. What does Athens have to do with Jerusalem? What does rationality have to do with revelation? What does philosophy have to do with religion, with obedience? And similarly, this question is implicit, at least, in all of Islamic thought. What does Athens have to do with Mecca? Mecca being the parallel of Jerusalem, of course. What are the sources of jurisprudence? What are the sources? Well, certainly reason is not a major source of jurisprudence, although it is a method of jurisprudence. The sources of jurisprudence are four. First, the revelation, obviously, is the foremost source of law. In recent years, with the Islamic revival in many parts of the world, revivalist Muslims have said, back to the Quran. It's a kind of fundamentalist movement in the sense of going back to the fundamentals in a way that exactly parallels Christian Protestant fundamentalism in the latter part of the 19th, early part of this century, which is still continuing very much. We find functional parallels constantly between fundamentalist Christianity and fundamentalist Islam. Quran, because this is the word of God, and it is immutable, infallible, and we must accept it as it is. But then the Quran does not pronounce on everything that we need guidance on. It is limited. It's only, as I was saying, the length of the New Testament, roughly, and it's marvelous, and it implies many things, but it does not state specifically everything that one needs to know in managing a large and complex society, which the movement became from the time it moved to Medina after the Hijra. So after the death of the Prophet, indeed during his life, Muhammad's exemplary, or his acts and his words were considered to be exemplary. People followed everything he did.
And what he did, the sum of it, is called his sunnah. The word sunnah in pre-Islamic usage meant customary behavior, a pattern of life. It even meant beaten path, like a little path across the grass that everybody takes, whether they're supposed to or not. The way to go. Muhammad's sunnah is preserved in a literary form called hadith. The word hadith means simply something new. What's new? What's hadith? What's the news? What's the information? What's going on? That sort of thing. But the hadith became a formalized sort of phenomenon in which a single hadith has two parts. It has an isnad and a matan. Okay? Now, most of us, when we want to know something for our guidance, want to know specifically what Muhammad said or did. Okay? There is a typical hadith that goes like this: do not eat garlic or onions before going to the mosque, because God does not like such a smell in the worship context. Another one: when you lie down on your back, do not cross your legs, because God does not like people who cross their legs. I'm not trying to distort the whole presentation here, but hadiths range from such very common, indeed almost coarse sort of matters, all the way to Muhammad's exalted insights into the prayer life, into the nature of God, into the experiences he has had in receiving the revelation, and into the terrible ordeals that he went through as a leader of people and as a person with children and who knew tragedy. The matan is what I've just told you. It's the freight of the hadith. It's the story. It's what everybody wants to get to first. But without the isnad, the matan is worthless. And what is the matan, or the isnad? The isnad is the chain of attestors to the veracity of the hadith. Each hadith has a kind of apostolic succession, a chain of reliable witnesses who have transmitted the hadith all the way back to the prophet. And so that this becomes a science of hadith known as the science of men or humans. You cannot tell whether a hadith and the whole sunnah is contained in thousands of hadith which have been collected into books. All of them together comprise the sunnah, or the exemplary way of the prophet. You cannot tell whether a matan is true necessarily on the basis of its content, because there are any number of thousand that could be plausible. He could have said this. He could have done that. You only know it if you have a reliable isnad of people who were known to be veracious, known to have been in the right place at the right time, known to have had certain contacts with each other, known to have been pious, and other qualifications. Here is another example of the importance of community in Islam, the importance of individual humans, and the reliance that people have on them and their testimony. So the isnad and the matan must go together to make the hadith in order to validate the sunnah, which is the teaching of the prophet, either by precept, word, or example. So the Quran and the sunnah, then, are the great pillars, you might say, or the great sources of jurisprudence, which constitutes the Sharia. Both of these are held to be part of the divine legislation, because the Quran itself says that Muhammad is infallible and to be honored, not to be worshipped. Muhammad is a man, a human, but to be honored and to be believed, and a reliable guide and a reliable witness. There are a number of collections of hadith. If you're interested in researching this on your own, there are two that have been considered the greatest and the most reliable, sound as they're called. And they're by these two people, Al-Bukhari and Muslim, a man named Muslim. That's his actual name. Both of them lived in the 800s of the Common Era. Both of them examined over 500,000 individual hadiths. They did it by literary sources, and they also did it by extensive traveling in order to receive firsthand from people stories coming from Muhammad, and then they tested them. Bukhari, as I recall, examined perhaps 600,000 different hadiths. And after he finished his collection, which is called the Sahih, this simply means true or sound collection, there were only about 2,000. They perfected the scientific use of the isnad. Although it had been a theory before, they really perfected it and they compared things. And this resulted in the development of vast biographical dictionary projects, which are a historian's delight, because they give so much information about people, testimonies about them, the dates, their movements, their education, their dialects. And so we do have different isnads, all the way from sahih down several grades to weak to unacceptable. Law needs as much information as it can get. So you may have a hadith which seems fine, but it's missing a link. Oftentimes, a hadith which can be traced in many different areas may have different types of isnads, let's say. I mean, they still have the hadith, but they can't find all the links. There's a good chance that that's true, because it's been independently transmitted in different areas, even with different languages, and maybe with variants. But there's a very good chance that that's true because of the migration patterns of the Arabs in the early generations of Islam. I won't get into the details more, but you know, it's fascinating stuff. I mean, this is why people spend their lives with this. The hadith scholars are the Talmudists of Islam. They love this. And I do too, I must say. It's the sort of thing I can lose myself on a snowy afternoon and never come up for air afterwards. You become a rabbi when you do this, because it becomes, I mean, because you're dealing with such beautiful materials. You're dealing with very human materials about eating onions or garlic or running races with your wife when she's fat or she's thin, as I told you last night, or praying and loving three things, prayer, perfume, and women, as Muhammad said, he did. And then you're dealing with such things as the most exalted images of God. There's another hadith, which is wonderful. A man was sitting reading the Quran one night, and his horse started kicking and going, you know, like this on the in the stable. And the man was wondering what in the world was wrong with his horse, because he'd never behaved like that before. So he went to the Prophet the next day and said, he told him the story. Ah, Muhammad said, that's because you were reciting the Quran. That's why the horse did that. Horses do this when you recite the Quran. And why, he said, because God's spirit always descends on a sincere person when reciting the Quran, and the horse felt this spirit nearby and became spooked, literally spooked the horse. Now that's a funny story at first, but when you start to think about it, you begin to see that all creation is involved in this spiritual experience. The horse cannot interpret this. The horse can only trust his owner, his master. But the man was wondering about it too. And so the spirit came down. There is this sacramental quality of reciting the Quran that I mentioned last night. Quran and Sunnah. And then we have another source of jurisprudence. The Quran says don't drink wine. The Sunnah says don't drink wine. What about Johnny Walker? Or beef eaters? It doesn't say anything about those. So you have another source. And that is known as qiyas. It's not a literary source, it's a methodological source. This is analogical reasoning, which lawyers always use everywhere at all times. No, you can't drink Johnny Walker or beef eaters either. Why? Well, I think you can supply the answer for that on analogy. I've given you an absurdly simple case. There are much more difficult ones, of course, which we know of in our own society. But analogy becomes one of the sources of jurisprudence in the absence of clear direction from either of these. Then, if there is no analogy that's possible, there is always this last, which is known as ijma'. And this is consensus of the scholars. It simply means consensus, but it's consensus of those who are qualified. In the early development of jurisprudence, in the absence of any inherited method, people began using their personal opinion, and they were trusted, by and large, because of their knowledge of the Quran and the Prophet,
but they also used their personal opinion because there weren't any accepted procedures. This opinion finally, after a couple of centuries, developed into fairly accepted rules of analogical reasoning. As long as people were convinced that they weren't leading their major sources too much, but subordinating the analogical process to this. There are Islamic legists or jurisprudence experts who distrust qiyas because they feel that you can just end up in rationalization and in casuistry of the Jesuit sort very easily, where the ends justifies the means. So qiyas is the sometimes the black sheep in this little flock here, as you can imagine it would be. In any large legal-oriented religion, you're going to have an awful lot of lawyers. And you're going to have a whole system which can be gamed, as well as a system which tries to dispense justice. Ijma, consensus, is an interesting one. There's always been a large place for consensus because of the community-mindedness of the Muslims, particularly the majority group of the Sunnis. I'll define that a little bit later. Not so much among the Shi'is, or the Shiites. I'll just give them this Western spelling. Ijma is based on a hadith, as well as on the inherited practice of the Arabs, who, like the Plains Indians, always wanted to agree together on something before they made a decision, and they didn't want loss of face. So they would tend to have a unanimous agreement on things. But there is a hadith that is purportedly from the Prophet Muhammad, which goes like this: "Verily, my community shall never agree together on an error." That's a very handy hadith, because it's exactly parallel to the old Roman Latin notion of vox populi, voice of the people, is the voice of God. Vox populi, vox Dei. And it's very populist, in the sense that, how can we be wrong? The Prophet said, if we agree together, that's tantamount to revelation. It's never called revelation, but it's called reliable. So this has given Islam a great deal of its conservatism. Because what happened when ijma'a, I've given you, this, we don't have this sound, but I have to give it because that's what's there, ijma'a, it's an ayn, actually came to dominate jurisprudence as it would, because in the succeeding years of the development of jurisprudence, after the freshness of pioneering efforts at independent legal thinking was passed, people began to look back not just to the Quran and to the Prophet, but also to the early experts in jurisprudence. And they said, well, that old expert said this, and what's good enough for Jesus is good enough for me, sort of thing. And then they would begin to inherit the rabbi's thoughts, so to speak, and make that into almost scripture itself. And this became terribly, I would say, my words only, sclerotic. It really rigidified the Islamic system. And Islamic revivalists are admitting it, that it did actually and ironically close up the system so that free inquiry was pretty much cut off after about the 3rd or 4th century of Islam, and people just went back to precedent all the time, or to earlier decisions, and didn't make any new decisions. There were always those pioneers who came out and wanted to break through. And you break through in this way. You've heard of the word jihad, or as it's often mispronounced on the radio, even national public radio, jihad. Islamic jihad movement got them. Well, you know that word. It's jihad, damn it. And this is the way it goes. I feel like throttling the, Carl Castle on the radio, although I like him otherwise in the morning. That jihad movement got our Marines again, that sort of thing. But it's jihad. And this word means exertion. It extends to holy warfare. But it is not limited to holy war. It is exertion. It may be defensive war, and it may be extending the areas of Islam. Although the Quran expressly says there is no compulsion in religion. But there can be compulsion as far as territory is concerned. You may not force people to accept your religion, but you can force people to be under your rule and to live as a minority. And this, of course, has often happened in India and other places as well. But jihad, the word means exertion.
or struggle. The Prophet said in a hadith, there are two jihads. There's the greater jihad and there is the lesser jihad. The lesser jihad is warfare in the way of Allah. Okay? The greater jihad is each individual's struggle with the spirit, with his sin, with the quest for authenticity. That's the greater jihad, and that goes on all the time. Ijtihad is related to it. I'll give you a little Arabic lesson. Has anybody ever studied Hebrew or Arabic in here? Well, it's great fun once you get into it. All Semitic languages are root languages. These are the roots of this word. This complex, J-H-D, whenever you have it, always has to do with exertion of some sort or struggle. Ijtihad, you can look once you have the eyes to do it, and you'll find the same root, ijtihad. This is intellectual exertion, and it comes to mean independent legal decision-making, not the kind that is bound to a received tradition, but one which seeks, putting it in Protestant theological terms or Catholic theological terms, to relate the word to this world for the need of today, not just to blindly imitate the past. And so there have always been people who have tried to invoke ijtihad, and they are mujtahids. The J-H-D is still there. Arabic is just neat because it has such a nice locked-in sort of semantic structure. A mujtahid, then, is a person who is an independent legal scholar. They're relatively rare. Anybody who claimed in the past to be a mujtahid was often taken severely to task for being an innovator. And the Arabic word bid'ah means innovation, and that is the Muslim word for heresy. Innovation, and bringing anything new in, is the closest word to heresy.
Were they killed often?
Not often. They were studiously ignored often. Some of them never lived to see their views accepted, but some of them have endured as saints centuries after, who were courageous in their time, and much later their views were accepted. That has sometimes happened. Not often, though. You know, in older days, before we had law schools all over the country, people would go and read law with a lawyer who had passed the bar and who was successful. I know when I was a kid in Vermont, people were still reading law in some small town. They'd go and they'd read law with this fellow for 6, 7, 8 years, and then they'd pass the bar themselves. You might find a mujtahid like that, where people would come to him and read law, who couldn't go to school, couldn't afford it, maybe never went to college. And that sort of thing, so you'd find that occasionally. Let me give you an example of a person that claimed to be a mujtahid and what the results of his thinking were. His name was Ibn Taymiyyah. I'll give you the short name. He was from Damascus. It is said often among scholars that the gate of ijtihad closed around 900 of the Common Era, which is a little less than 3 centuries after the death of Muhammad. He died in 632. The gate of ijtihad never closed completely. There were always people who claimed ijtihad. The opposite of ijtihad, by the way, is taqlid, which is blind imitation of the past, conservatism of the most slavish type. But Ibn Taymiyyah, who died in 1328, is a person who said, there must be ijtihad or we die as a community. We just must have this. Ibn Taymiyyah was a person who was, in some ways, the Jerry Falwell of his time. He was a real fundamentalist. And so people did listen to him. But he was so fundamental. He was fundamentaler than the fundamentalists. And he saw, like certain people who are stubborn in their own way, he saw that you have to have independent legal decision-making, which then must be subjected to the tests of the community. In other words, he was not a maverick in the sense that he wanted to go out all by himself. But he said, you have to have courageous thinking through of things. Otherwise, we are not using the Quran, which is meant for all seasons. He felt that the Quran and the Sunnah, too, had been encrusted in ages of traditionalism. And he wanted to break through that crust and to release the power of these. That is a fundamentalist in the truest sense, or I would say rather a radical, who wants to go back to the roots in the sense of radix. So Ibn Taymiyyah, Ibn Taymiyyah was a wonderful man. I really love him. I don't know why I love him, but in certain ways. But I wanted to study Ibn Taymiyyah when I was in graduate school. And none of my professors wanted to study Ibn Taymiyyah because they thought he was just an old poop, you know, an old fundamentalist, an old musty guy. And they hadn't really looked at him, some of them, except one man from Pakistan, one of my professors. But he didn't really want to study Ibn Taymiyyah either. But finally, I got two or three other students together. We went to him and said, "Can we read Ibn Taymiyyah this year?" And he said, "Okay," like that. And so we read several times a week in his office around his table. And it was a revelation for all of us to go back into some of the materials that hadn't been read in a long time and how fresh and vibrant this man was. He was a Hanbali, which is the strictest of the four schools of law. This is the school of law that is the official school in Saudi Arabia, to give you an idea of how strict it is, and literalist. But Ibn Taymiyyah had taken upon himself the task of combating the theologians, who he thought were damaging Islam through their rationalism. They were undermining the revelation. Well, he became so good at combating the theologians that he became a premier theologian in the process, because you really have to. Sort of like the old Socrates question, must we philosophize? Well, answer that for yourself. You can walk away, and that may be your answer, but if you stay in the room, you must philosophize. Isn't that true? Either to refute or to agree. And so there's a very similar thing at work here. So Ibn Taymiyyah spent much of his adult life in prison because he made everybody so mad. Because he was always claiming to be a mujtahid and saying, no, we can't go the old ways any longer. The Quran says this. Haven't you ever read it? And even important people, he would say things like this to. But he had the satisfaction, I don't know how satisfied he felt, because he was curmudgeonly. Somebody couldn't exist in that situation without being a curmudgeon. Because if he didn't have a hard shell himself, everybody would have punctured him and killed him and drained off his blood. I mean, he was tough. But in jail, he found his enemies coming to him for legal decisions because they knew that this guy could not be bought. And they would accept his legal decisions, even when he was in jail. His greatest hatred was visiting the tombs of deceased Muslims who had become saints. Now, Christians have always done this too. They've visited tombs, burial places. They've, you know, kissed the thing and rubbed it. If you've ever been to Latin America or to the Mediterranean and you see people putting them from the tomb and rubbing it on them and on their loved ones and their children and so forth. This is a pattern of culture in many parts of the world, whether it's Islamic or Christian or Hindu and so forth. He thought this was the worst kind of idolatry imaginable. And he's right. So he said, you must never visit saints' tombs. The only places you can visit are Mecca to do the pilgrimage or go to Medina to pay your chaste respects to the Prophet, but never to this kissing and this rubbing of the tombs and so on and so forth. And so he wrote many tracts against that. He made people quite angry because that was the rage in his day, was visiting tombs all over the place in Palestine and Syria and Egypt and Mecca and so forth. And there was always a thumping trade involved with this because pilgrimage sites make a lot of money. As we know, Estes Park is a pilgrimage site in Vail and Aspen and all of these places in the modern world. And businesses and concessions and so forth in Boulder do very well. Ibn Taymiyyah, when he died, and he died partly because of despondency, they finally took his ink and papers away from him, and he died shortly after. For years, they allowed him to write. If he hadn't been in jail much of his adult life, we wouldn't know much about him, because he spent that period to write and also to teach people who would come to his cell to be taught. People go to holy sites to receive barakah, which is blessing, power, spiritual power, sort of electricity of heaven. Ibn Taymiyyah, when he died, 600,000 people showed up for his funeral. And after that, they all started visiting his grave for barakah. He was a victim of his virtues. Yeah. So anyway, but he died in 1328. In 1708, a person was born in Arabia by the name of Muhammad ibn Abd al-Wahhab. Abd al-Wahhab was also a Hanbali. He had been a Sufi, a mystic. But he read Ibn Taymiyyah, and he became a reformer in Arabia and led in what is known as the Wahhabi movement. Excuse me, that's a B. And that revolutionized Arabia. His soldiers went around Arabia and neighboring places, tearing down mausoleums and monuments and cemeteries right and left, which had been erected to the memory of saints, of individual Muslims. And he said, absolutely not, these must all be destroyed, and he succeeded. And this Wahhabi reform has continued to be the official way of Saudi Arabia to this day, Wahhabism. So that when you go to Saudi Arabia, there are no tombs. Even King Faisal, who was assassinated by a CU student a few years ago, you may remember, one of the princes, was buried in a plain grave with just a little simple marker. And that is a result of Ibn Abd al-Wahhab's reform, which was based on Ibn Taymiyyah. And Ibn Taymiyyah was the person who was the mujtahid of his time, who blew the whistle and nobody listened. They all came to his funeral. But I've likened Ibn Taymiyyah's work against saint veneration, against idolatry of this sort, to a kind of time bomb that he planted, and it ticked and ticked and ticked, and finally it exploded in Arabia 4 centuries later. And it's still reverberating across the world, because Ibn Taymiyyah is probably the chief theologian of the modern Islamic revival in many ways. He is a real hero. His works are all in print in Saudi Arabia and distributed all over the Islamic world in beautiful leather editions with gold writing, printing on it. All you have to do is write to Saudi Arabia and ask for a set of Ibn Taymiyyah, and the likelihood is that they'll send it to you, because right along with the Quran, because it becomes a kind of a way of appreciating all of this. I don't take me literally on that, but they do distribute a lot of books of Ibn Taymiyyah. So here's an example of a mujtahid and a jurist, one who is one of the great custodians of the law.